Welcome to the Dermatology Podcast, the official podcast of the European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology. I'm Christopher Horskamp.
And I'm Cécile Mitoir.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is Professor Dede Morel, who will discuss autoimmune blistering diseases, research, practice, and patient support. But first, on Wednesday the 13th of January at 2 p.m. Central European Time, the EADV is hosting its first webcast of the year, Pearls on Peels. Dr. George Kontokristopoulos, Dr. Fotini Beyorgo, and Dr. Marina Landau will give a one-hour webcast focused on chemical peels with tips useful for every practitioner. The webcast will be available on YouTube, Facebook Live, and for members on the EADV e-learning platform. And now? Today we'll be speaking with Professor Dede Morel. She's currently serving as the professor and head of Department of Dermatology at St. George Hospital, a teaching hospital of the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. She's also the director at Premier Specialists Research and Development. So she's studied and worked all over, from Oxford and Cambridge Medical Schools, Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Rockefeller University in New York, and then on to St. George Hospital, where she is today. In the meantime, she set up her own private dermatology practice and the first dedicated dermatology trial center in Australia. This allowed her to combine her passion for medical research and interest in new therapies for common and rare skin conditions, in particular, genetic and autoimmune blistering diseases, or as we'll refer to them in the show, AIBD. In 2006, she started the Australasian Blistering Diseases Foundation, with one of her research fellows at the time, Dr. Linda Martin. Over the years, the foundation has funded numerous medical research projects to find better ways to diagnose and treat rare blistering diseases. Professor Morel, thank you for being with us today.
Welcome, Professor Morel.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to meet both of you, both Chris and Cécile. It's a delight to see you both looking bright and perky in the morning over there in Europe.
It's lovely to have you here. Could you tell us a little bit about your professional journey and, more importantly, your motivation?
Chris, I think you summarized my professional journey better than I could. You have been fortunate in being able to work in these different countries and different settings, and to learn about academia and a little bit about private practice in Europe, in the United States, and most recently in Australia. Through all of these experiences, I have also been able to see different organizations such as the American Academy of Dermatology, the European Academy of Dermatology, and the Women's Dermatology Society, which has been an international group in the United States, which has very much influenced my career in terms of providing opportunities for mentorship, for international exchange. And a lot of my research has come out of international exchange with like-minded people. And I was fortunate that when I moved to Sydney, the internet was just sort of getting going. And had that not been the case, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to collaborate with people as I can from such a long distance. I think being able to have the chance to not just travel to the AAD and the EADV, but to be able to take part in all the grant writing, paper writing, reviewing for journals. In the olden days, everything was by snail mail. But now it doesn't matter where we are. I can have this interview with you on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And, it doesn't really matter that I'm so far away from you. So I think that all of these things are making things much easier to be more international across the world.
Absolutely.
For example, research used to be, there's the European way of doing everything and there's the American way of doing everything. And people would have to repeat studies on two continents quite mm-hmm. often because of this person's view of what's the definition of a disease. And now it's becoming more and more it's an international consensus of how to treat something or an international score for how to measure a disease. And the drug company people where I do the trials were saying that in dermatology, we're particularly collaborative, whereas in some other fields of medicine, they say that they have to do trials again, because in one country or North America, they believe in this is the best way to measure something. And in say, surgery or rheumatology or something else. In Europe, they have to do it another way. But because dermatologists are very collaborative as a group, that we have got more disease outcome measures and things that we agree upon between ourselves. So that's been one of my things that I got involved in after I became a consultant and have been able to continue despite living so far away.
And reading up on your bio, it says that your research interests include acne, psoriasis, and skin cancer, to name a few. And today we would like to focus on your expertise in autoimmune blistering diseases, AIBD. So what are autoimmune blistering diseases, and what do we know about their clinical manifestation, diagnosis, interventional options, and etiology?
Without going into a lot of detail, these are diseases of skin fragility and blistering, which attack the outer layers of the skin and the basement membrane zone. The patient's producing autoantibodies that attack different adhesion proteins within the skin, and they produce different manifestations depending on the layer of the skin that is detached and the regions of the body that are predilected, because in some diseases, the face and scalp, for example, in pemphigus, are more predisposed, whilst in bullous pemphigoid, it's more the flexural aspects of the limbs and the palms and soles that are attacked with the blisters.
Are patients with AIBD at greater risk to develop osteoporosis?
Patients with these diseases generally develop osteoporosis as a result of the treatment that they receive to control the blistering, because the majority of patients receive corticosteroids to treat these diseases. Corticosteroids reduce the amount of collagen that your body produces and the turnover of collagen. So therefore, not only does your skin become thinner, but your bones become thinner.
How do autoimmune blistering diseases affect quality of life and work productivity?
I have done quite a bit of research on quality of life and work productivity and how it's affected in these diseases. Quality of life is greatly affected by having an autoimmune blistering disease. It's equivalent to patients who've got serious heart conditions, very severe diabetes, if you want to compare it to other branches of medicine. It's particularly harsh on young women whose faces are affected quite often, particularly with pemphigus. And in young people who get these diseases, it can affect their relationships, so whether they get a life partner or not. In terms of jobs, pemphigus affects it more than pemphigoid, because pemphigus is a disease that develops in working age adults, whereas pemphigoid tends to happen in retirement. So you're more likely to lose your job if you have pemphigus than bullous pemphigoid.
Now, concerning the updated S2K guidelines on the management of pemphigus vulgaris and pemphigus foliaceus initiated by the EADV that was recently published in the JEADV, what do you consider the most important changes to keep in mind?
The most important changes are the recent study published from the French dermatology group, which was a randomized controlled trial of rituximab plus low doses of steroids, which were randomized against conventional therapy with high doses of steroids. This study showed for the first time that rituximab could drastically improve the complete remission rates of patients with pemphigus, could significantly reduce the steroid burden and the degree of side effects suffered by these patients. They had 7 times longer remissions than they did with the conventional therapy. And this independent study conducted in France in multiple sites led to the FDA registering rituximab as indication for the first time a drug had been indicated for pemphigus. Roche, which is the company that has rituximab, also ran a sponsored clinical trial, which had similar results, hasn't been published yet. And so the FDA approved the drug on the basis of this independent study, which is possibly a first, I'm not sure. It was really, really an incredible study led by Pascal Joly, a longstanding member of the EADV, who has run one of the EADV conferences actually in Paris before. and the French group Boulle. So the guideline changed significantly as a result of that study published in The Lancet in 2017 and the subsequent FDA approval of rituximab for pemphigus.
Now this was published in the JADV. Is there a concurrent publication in the...
Oh, sorry. The rituximab study was a landmark study published in The Lancet. Mm-hmm. But then our international group, which meets every year at the EADV, they have a task force for autoimmune blistering diseases. Mm-hmm. And they have their own EADV guidelines. And so those guidelines had to be updated as a result of this study that had been published in Lancet.
Okay.
And that's the S2K guidelines were changed to.
Let's change topics a little bit. How can better understanding of genetics help dermatologists appreciate the variability and severity of epidermolysis bullosa?
Epidermolysis bullosa, or EB for short, is one of many genetic skin disorders that dermatologists have to diagnose and manage. In medical schools in many countries, unfortunately, medical students don't receive much education in genetics. And it's becoming more and more important for medical students and doctors to be able to understand genetics. As we've discovered more and more about the genetic basis of disease and having to explain to parents about how they have passed on a disease or how their child has developed a disease despite them not having the gene mutation for it. And doctors who haven't really understood or been educated very much in genetics in medical school, of course, they'll struggle with themselves understanding it and explaining it to patients. So I think if it's an important part of the curriculum of becoming a dermatologist, because we have many, many genetic diseases within dermatology, mm-hmm. EB is one example. EB includes an umbrella of about 20 different subtypes of EB caused by at least 20 different genes, each with their own particular foibles about how they're inherited. Are they autosomal dominant? Are they autosomal recessive? Is there mosaicism within this particular condition? Do they have interactions with other genetic variabilities in adhesion proteins in the skin that express or influence whether that disease appears as a really nasty, fatal disease or whether it is a disease that's going to not be too severe in the life of the child. And the parents need to understand what the risk is for the subsequent baby having the same condition or whether it's very unlikely that the child will have it. And then what types of mutations there are is now influencing what types of therapies the patient could receive, because there's now some targeted therapies that depend on the gene involved, the type of mutation involved. And because genetics is quite complicated, dermatologists are already used to quite complicated conditions. We have something right. like 7,000 different yeah. conditions to distinguish one from the next. And so fortunately, many people in this specialty are attracted to intellectually more difficult concepts, and people who enjoy pediatric dermatology have to understand a lot of genetics, because a lot of the things that present in children are genetically related. But more and more they're finding some diseases have late onset, and that many childhood conditions which are genetic due to better medical treatment end up as little adults with genetic conditions. Mm-hmm. And so EB is a really interesting area within dermatology and a promising area for new treatments.
Switching gears again, one of your major projects was you set up the first dedicated dermatology trial center in Australia. How do you envision the impact of this on patient care?
Well, when I went to Australia for the first time to work there, I didn't know much about the system there. I'd only been there as a medical student for a few months. And when I arrived at my hospital, I was even more surprised to find that they had no trainees in dermatology there either. And yet it was a teaching hospital. And so I rapidly realized that in Australia, most of dermatology is in private practice, and that for some strange reason, the government seems to think that most teaching hospitals don't even need dermatologists. So there's a huge emphasis on patient care in the outpatient setting rather than the inpatient setting. And there's also an extreme shortage of dermatologists, and the patients generally get referred to us by their GPs. So in terms of research and clinical trials that I'd already experienced in the United States, I knew how to perform trials, how to get ethics approved, how to do statistical analysis, and I'd really enjoyed doing that when I was in the US. When companies came along and said, hey, we're looking for somebody who wouldn't mind doing clinical trial of a new treatment to prevent skin cancer, which is, of course, the common place in the world where you find skin cancer. I said, yes, I would like to be able to do that. I could set up part of my department to run trials, and I could find trainees who want to become dermatologists who I can train them how to do this. And so it began as a very small enterprise within my department. But as it got bigger and bigger and we were pushed for space, then it moved into my part-time private practice where I run the trial center. And now most dermatologists who run trial centers in Australia do so through their practices. There just isn't much dedicated hospital space to dermatology here.
So do you see that? Do you see that in and of itself as the biggest current challenge in medical education and in dermatology, or do you see that there might be a couple different challenges happening?
I think that clinical trials are really, really important in every branch of medicine and in dermatology, especially so. We have so many skin diseases, and so up until recently, a lot of the treatments only suppressed the skin disease to a small extent. Mm-hmm. But thanks to all of these trials, we're getting biological treatments and other treatments that are making patients' skin diseases disappear completely whilst on medications that don't cause too many side effects. And it's through these clinical trials that these drugs have become approved. The majority of these trials in dermatology have been done in the outpatient setting because they're chronic skin diseases that are non-life-threatening but which affect quality of life of patients. So the big trial centers in, at least in the United States, tend to often be, well, they're all outpatient based, and many of them are conducted in a private setting. In Europe, it's slightly different. They tend to do a lot of the trials in teaching hospitals, but the Europeans have big dermatology buildings, big departments still. Mm-hmm. It's more traditional that way.
And now we have the women in dermatology questions. How has being a woman affected your career?
In my medical school in Cambridge, about a third of the students were women. And in my clinical school at Oxford, I think it was a slightly higher proportion of women. Yet when I was training there, I only met three female consultants, and two of whom were dermatologists and one was a pediatrician. And although I was interested in many different branches of medicine, I wonder in retrospect if meeting these women dermatologists had a sort of subconscious influence on me. I mean, I love dermatology. I found it really fascinating. But the fact that there were some women who appeared to have a normal life, that they were married and had children and had academic careers, that was the first time I sort of encountered that as a with having a female role model. And when I moved to the United States, I found there were a lot more women in every branch of medicine. It was much more even in terms of women in medicine. And in dermatology especially, there was already, when I was training at Chapel Hill, a majority of the trainees were women. And some of the consultants were women. And that's how I got introduced to the Women's Dermatology Society, founded in the United States about 40 years ago. When in those days there was a very small proportion of women in the specialty, and they decided to set up the group to help other women to navigate having a career, having a family, etc. So it's really a group of women who like mentorship, who like to mentor young people who aren't their children, but they kind of adopt them as, you know, giving them career advice. And actually they adopt boys as well as girls. It doesn't really matter that the person has to be female. What matters is that one of the two, either the mentor or the mentee, should be female. So I've had plenty of great mentors who are men over my career. And likewise, I've had male dermatology trainees from the US come to Sydney, probably actually more men than women who've come supported by the Women's Derm Society to experience dermatology in another country. So people don't know that. And there are 10% of the members of the Women's Derm who are male. And actually a lot of them are either future leaders or current leaders in dermatology who feel that both genders or both sexes need to be supported, not just one or the other. And they're more kind of paternalistic or maternalistic nurturers kind of people that get involved in that society. And it's easy to make friends in that group. It's not just a group of people who are sort of pushing ahead for themselves. So I found that group to be very nurturing. I should have just called it the Nurturing Dermatology Society. That would have been a better name.
Yeah, actually, the next question was a bit about that, because you received the Women's Dermatology Society Mentor of the Year Award in 2013. And what does tackling gender equity and being a mentor mean to you?
Being a mentor is a privilege. It's you get to be a mentor to your own children if you're lucky enough to have your own children, but you have to let them do what they want to do. In this case, you have the ability to influence the careers of people who like the same things that you like. And you've got that window, that you've got that wisdom after many years of knowing the shortcuts and the ways to get to things without sort of going down a blind alley. And you can really help people by introducing them to people in the field who have the similar interest to them. So for example, I'm not surgical. I'm not surgically inclined, I'm not cosmetically inclined, but if I'm mentoring someone who that's what they want to do, then through my network of friends, I know who the people are that I need to introduce them to help them, and where some people would be in another country, perhaps, that they might find interesting to go and work in. And so it's really networking and helping people who are just at the beginning of their career to find people that can, you know, assist them. And of course, not everyone's interested in doing that, but I am. And I like all those connections that you make. And seeing some of my young people who are now leaders in the field, are now professors, and now the youngest journal editor of the Clinical Experimental Dermatology, Alexa Shipman. She was a medical student, elective student with me, back in the day, and when I was early in my days at St. George Hospital, and she came over with her twin sister to do electives at our hospital. And then, you know, now there she is, the youngest editor of a journal, international journal. So
who were your mentors? Who stood out?
Okay, I had lots of great mentors, fortunately. One of them passed away this year, so I'd like to particularly acknowledge him. And I co-wrote an obituary about him in the British Journal of Dermatology. His name is Al Briggerman, and he was my chairman when I got accepted at UNC Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. And he was just a darling, and there's so many people that remembered him when he died and wrote lovely things about him. And he was just a very kind person who, not only brilliant, but very modest. And, you know, he greatly helped me with my career. Then, interestingly, Wilma Bergfeld, who's a dermatologist practicing at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, and she's the woman who becomes the first president of the Women's Derm Society. And she also was the first woman president of the American Academy of Dermatology. Mm-hmm. And married to an orthopedic surgeon, as am I, so we have that in common. We're in the skin and bone club together. Mm-hmm. So we understand what it's like to be also the wife of a strong man who has his own career agenda. So that was another thing in common that I had with her. and still have with her. And there's a few dermatologists I've met along the way who are married to orthopedic surgeons. So we're in our little subset of the skin and bone club. Steve Cossard, he's a dermatopathologist and dermatologist here in Australia, one of the first leaders really in academics in this country. And he had been at the Mayo Clinic and published a lot. And when he came back to Australia, he was the first person who'd been subspecialized in dermatopathology. And he's been a mentor to many people here in academics. I could go on with many people who've helped me a lot. I've been very fortunate. In terms of mentors, I've been grateful to meet through the EADV. I'd like to give credit to Carl Paul, the president of the EADV, and Branka Marinovic, the secretary general of the EADV. I met Carl through my interest in clinical trials and when he was working in Novartis, and got the opportunity as a relatively young dermatologist to work with them on the development of pimacrolimus for eczema and the EASI score validation. And through Branka, got many opportunities to come and lecture in Europe, in Croatia, in her department, and to work together in the blistering diseases group and to sort of co-mentor younger dermatologists. And they have both been influential in getting me more involved in committee work, such that I became elected onto the international board member of the EADV. So I'm really grateful for them.
If you could send a message to every fellow dermatologist and to every dermatologic patient, if you like, what would you say?
If you have a difficult to diagnose or difficult to treat problem, then try to find a dermatologist who will be fascinated by your problem, curious about you as a person, and not give up on you and keep on trying, because if someone can't solve your problem for you, you want to find a doctor who's engaged in your particular problem and wants to really help you to get better.
Professor Morel, we really thank you for being with us today. We've enjoyed the talk and appreciate your time.
Thank you for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you very much to both of you and to the JEADV for having this initiative to run some podcasts in dermatology. Thank you for your time.
That again was Professor Dede Morel sharing with us her experience and knowledge on a number of topics. For more information on any of this research, you can find the original articles in the Journal of the European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology. Thank you for joining us today. We've enjoyed bringing you this interview. And until the next time,
take care of your skin.